gardens, and Konstich objects. This Duque knew, for he remembered Captain Verdwijnen waking him from a deep sleep one night.
Get up! There is a great sight! Awake!
And commanding him to come on deck immediately to see a wonder. Swaying in his nightshirt, barefoot and bleary, he clung to the rail and looked down. The water curling back from the rushing ship's prow was a froth of luminescence, and behind them, the fiery glow marked their recent passage.
Look! See there!
Cried Captain Verdwijnen, gesturing at the water-riding phosphor and waving his hands. Alongside the ship, the bodies of dolphins trailed sparks that twisted and writhed as the fish moved. A sailor hauled up a bucket of quivering light. Captain Verdwijnen plunged his hands into it and held them up, his fingers and palms glowing as the water dripped away. The crests of the waves caught fire, darkened. The ship seemed to be sailing through a burning sea. Duque yawned, said,
"Remarkable,"
and returned to his blanket. Before they stepped into the palanquins, the translator said Wu Kwa had noticed the foreigner's pleasure in the garden earlier in the day, and the dinner invitation included a walk through his personal garden of vermilion dragonflies. But when they arrived and their host conducted them under the rustling trees, it was dark. There was no moon. The pathway was lighted by a tremble of distant lightning and by paper globes of imprisoned fireflies, which cast a greenish light. Of dragonflies, whether vermilion, amber, or blue, there was no sight. But Wu Kwa took their hands and led them to the darkest shade.
"We stand here under a duckfoot tree, the largest in the city. My garden was once part of an ancient temple, and this Yingguo tree was old then. They say it lived in the time before Buddha. It is not like any other tree. It is believed to be one of the first trees to live in the world."
In the darkness, he pulled at the leaves and gave one to Duque, another to Captain Verdwijnen.
"You must come another time in daylight to see the dragonflies," said Wu Kwa,
and led them into a room faced with intricate carved screens. 2 dozen lanterns threw a radiant light on the guests and the wine winking in silver bowls. Duque looked at the Yingguo leaf in his hand. It looked very like a leaf from a maidenhair fern which he had seen 1,000 times in the forests of the north. At the back of the room, musicians played in the Xinjiang style, and a performer sang in a high, strangled voice. The translator said the great dish of the dinner, following many courses, was called Buddha Leaps Over the Wall. Duque enjoyed it, while Captain Verdwijnen, longing for herring and head cheese, picked at it fearfully. On the way back to the factory quarter, Captain Verdwijnen said,
"I offer a wager that wall-jumping concoction will make you ill, perhaps kill you."
"It was worth it," said Duque.
Weeks passed before Wu Kwa deigned to consider Duque's offerings. He seemed to expect a request for ceramics, teas, lacquerware, and silks. He seemed to think Duque's pack contained silver. So when Duque took out the lustrous furs one by one, shaking them until they snapped with static electricity, Wu Kwa's face, trained never to show surprise, showed surprise. He took up a snowy Arctic fox fur and caressed it, examined the mink and marten furs, the ice-white ermine, and 2 thick sea otter pelts. At the sight of the velvet-black fur tipped with silver, the world's most desirable luxury, Wu Kwa sucked in his breath.
"Very pretty. Very, very pretty. We do not too often see furs of such beauty and quality. However, the Russians do bring us furs, so they are not unknown here. And in Guangzhou, it is really too warm for furs, but at court and in the north. What do you wish for these?"
Instead of the usual list of luxury goods, Duquesne named a very high price, in silver. Wukwa pretended to faint, his head slumped to one side, but watchful eyes glinting from the slitted lids. He revived and named a small sum that would be bolstered by a few rolls of silk and a bale of tea. Duquesne hurled himself to the floor in a fit of shrieking, spasmodic, disbelieving laughter. Even as he fell, he realized he had gone too far. He got up, sure he had lost face in the negotiations, and that the morning, perhaps the entire trip, was wasted. He sat again in his chair and looked at Wu Kua. The expression on the businessman's face was peculiar. Amazement? Disdain? But Wu Kua nodded his head, the slightest nod, but it expressed a kind of calculated admiration, an acceptance of Duquesne's behavior as a tolerable and even admirable ploy. Decorum returned. The day progressed, the bargaining continued. They again went to the garden for tea and arranged to meet in 2 days' time. At the end of the month of bargaining, Duquesne accepted a princely sum in silver for his furs. He had gained a staggering profit.
"If you come in a future year," said Wu Kua, "with furs of equal quality and variety, they may excite a greater passion."
The servant poured more tea. Wu Kua sipped, looked into the distance, and then asked offhandedly,
"And do you have this in your forests of New France?"
From his sleeve, he withdrew a gnarled root vaguely shaped like a hunchbacked three-legged man. Duquesne had seen this root before in the hands of the Indian woman who had saved his life.
"Yes, we have this."
"Ah, if you bring me a quantity of these roots, I will pay as much as for the furs, perhaps more, depending on the quality and quantity."
"Very good. And I also have rare woods for fine cabinets," said Duquesne, trembling inwardly, knowing he was on the edge of extraordinarily advantageous arrangements. "Rare woods are of interest, especially sandalwood. Scented woods are prized."
In a stroke, Duquesne had become a wealthy man, and he thought, after one or two more trips, if Captain Verdvinen were willing to take him, his forest enterprise would begin. As they spoke of woods, Duquesne was emboldened to ask a question.
"Sir, Honorable Wu Kua, as foreigners may not leave the factory compound, I have wondered many times about the forests of China. I see that men in China make gardens that seem the essence of forest and mountain, but in miniature. But what of the real forests? It is my belief that forests are everlasting and can never disappear, for they replenish themselves. But I have seen in France that they are diminished. And I have noticed that even in New France, the forest is drawing back a little wherever there are settlements. How far back can a forest withdraw before it replenishes itself?"
Wu Kua looked at him as though trying to judge whether or not Duquesne had designs on China's woodlands. He glanced at the translator. He hesitated.
"I can only say that China is very large and very old, with many people. More than that, I cannot say. Perhaps another time."
Duquesne understood that he was dismissed, rose, bowed, and backed away. After some months, Duquesne yearned to leave. It was irritating to wait for the monsoon to shift. Then, one day, Wu Kua requested his presence in the trading room. It was a clear, chill day in springtime, and outside, the wind cast plum blossom petals on the courtyard tiles. There was a different translator.
"You wished to know about our forests,"
said Wu Kua in a low, hurried voice, pausing impatiently for the translator.
I spoke with an elderly scholar on the subject. He said that our venerated sage, Meng Tzu, wrote of the people clearing land for crops, pulling grass and weeds, cutting trees ceaselessly, dividing the land and plowing. The people were very numerous, even in Meng Tzu's time, and very poor. People must eat or they die. They need fuel to cook rice. They must keep warm, so trees fall.
A rod of sunlight touched the toe of Wu Kua's black silk slipper.
We are a country of agriculture. You understand, of course, that land division is the base of all human government.
The forests, then, are diminished?
It is an arguable point, for men transplant many trees, bamboo, pine, oak, and the valuable ones that produce lacquer or rich oils. Bear in mind that if forests and timberlands are diminished, cropland is very much augmented. More food, more money, more people, more contentment.
Duquesne nodded, though he did not see contentment in this recipe. He knew very well that Wu Kua hoped to gain his favor by telling him these secret things.
But even beyond increasing our agricultural land, we cut forests for other reasons. For example, do you know the scholar's four treasures?
No, I regret to say I do not.
This is a country of scholars, poets, and calligraphers, said Wu Kua, and the four treasures are brush, paper, ink, and inkstone, the necessities of calligraphy. But the source of the ink is the soot from the burning of pine trees. Very many pine trees must burn to supply China's scholars.
The sunlight had moved up Wu Kua's robe and made a bright band across the embroidery.
And there was war, and metal workers, potters, brickmakers, all craftsmen's trades demand wood. In some tree-denuded places, peasants are forced to gather grass, twist it into hard bundles, and burn it as fuel. In other places, animal dung. He whispered, "There are wood shortages."
"So the forests of France and China are not everlasting," said Duquesne unhappily.
"And I have heard that Italy's mountains are stripped."
"Perhaps. But nothing is everlasting. Nothing. Not forests, not mountains."
"But how came the gardens that honor forests and wild country?"
"We do not forget the forests when we have removed the trees. We make gardens to give us the pleasurable illusions of wilderness."
"I myself," said Duquesne, "despise the gloomy and unruly forest, even while recognizing that it is a source of wealth and comforts. Yet I would never make a garden alluding to it."
"Of course you would not. You do not understand the saying, Tian Ren Ha Yi. It refers to a state of harmony between people and nature. You do not feel this. No European does. I cannot explain it to you. It is a kind of personal philosophy for each person, yet it is everything."
Duquesne thought it likely that the forests of China and France and Italy had been puny in their beginnings. He believed that the uniquely deep forests of the New World would endure. That was why men came to the unspoiled continent, for the mind-numbing abundance of virgin resources. Only he grasped the opportunity. Duquesne visited the ivory carver, who took a wax mold of his toothless jaws and set to work fashioning teeth. There was a wait of several months until they would be finished. The day came, and the carver showed him how to insert the plates of large white teeth hinged with fine gold wires. Duquesne looked in a glass for the first time in many years, and although the teeth felt monstrous and uncomfortable, they undeniably improved his appearance. The carver told him he would get used to the intrusive feeling, but that the teeth were only for display, not for chewing.
clean every day with brush, white cloth.
In pantomime, he showed Duquet that he must expect they would become yellow over time, especially if he let sunshine fall on them. It could not be helped. It was the nature of ivory. Perhaps he should have a second pair made for spares. Yes, nodded Duquet. He wondered if ceramic teeth could be fashioned, then thought of a likely mouthful of broken shards. Late every afternoon, when the day's continuing bargaining was finished, Duquet and Captain Verdwijnen enjoyed a glass of Jenever in the courtyard. The two men had become used to each other. Duquet, several times, between panegyrics on the forests of New France, said he wished to arrange another passage as soon as possible, but Captain Verdwijnen always slipped to another subject.
How do you like this pretty little table I bought for Marguerite? That old rogue Wuquois bargained as though I was trying to buy his precious dragonfly garden. At one point he actually fell off the chair and rolled on the floor, laughing like a madman. A complete loss of face. But in the end, I got it for a good price.
Ha! Laughed Duquet. Wuquois, the old rogue, had learned a new trick from him. Often, one or two of the captain's maritime friends, Piet Ros and Jan Hossen, captains of their own ships, dined with them. The face of Piet was like a pale plate set with two round eyes the color of raw sugar. His hair was almost the color of his skin and thus invisible. He dressed in the French mode, black silk culottes and coat set off by a froth of fine lace at the neck. Jan wore an immense sword and coarse workman's fustian trousers. These contrasting men seemed familiar to Duquet, and he finally asked about them.
Of course they are familiar. You saw them in the Rock and Shoal in La Rochelle.
Captain Verdwijnen lowered his voice to a whisper. I told you, they are my partners, my vrienden. Piet is my brother-in-law. Jan is my cousin. You didn't think I could defy the Vereenigde Oost-Indische Company and bear the expense of this voyage alone, did you?
Duquet said, I would like to be a partner with you for the sake of the furs, and for my future lumber enterprise. We could make money together, don't you think?
After a long silence, Captain Outher Verdwijnen spoke slowly.
You know that the Vereenigde Oost-Indische Company for many years tightly controlled Dutch trade with India, China, and Japan, the Spice Islands. No private merchant was allowed to do business nor travel through the Strait of Magellan. But men do try and succeed, said Duquet. If you tried and were caught, your goods were seized, your ship taken, and you were punished by the VOC's stony hand. That is what happened to Willem Schouten, who discovered Cap Horn. Now the company is weaker, but still watchful. My vrienden and I made a secret partnership to enter the India-China trade ourselves, and someday even Japan, by banding resources together and sailing together. This is our fourth voyage, and it is going well. Of course, Piet and Jan own their boats, and I am just the captain for Herr Grintz. But I hope to make enough on this trip to buy a good little flout. I am not altogether sure there is a place in our arrangement for a timber merchant. There may be, I don't know. I fear a flout could not carry great loads of timber. Our West Indies want lumber, but I prefer to continue the China trade. If I were you, I would look into the Indies trade.
But Duquet, with stubborn single-mindedness, began once again to describe the forests of New France. The Dutchman interrupted him.
My young friend, he said, allow someone with knowledge of the world to offer a comment. You speak always as though New France were your country. It is. Our fortunes are intertwined. It is a new world, rich and beauteous, with massive forests and powerful rivers. It is a place that has earned my respect. May I remind you that your New France is not a sovereign country, but the colony of a major European power? May I, from long observation of the political machinations of these great powers, introduce a note of caution? The kings of these strong countries do not know their colonies and overseas settlements. They have never been there, nor have their ministers. For them, those colonies are colored blotches on maps. They are only counters in the savage games of war, only sources of income. They do not give a fig for anything else. And I might observe that you are not wary enough of France's European enemies, especially England. It might fall out that France trades or otherwise divests itself of New France, as the occasion dictates. That could never happen. Of course not. But I have heard that France, the mother country, is not particularly enamored of New France, that supply ships are often very late, that she keeps her population at home instead of urging settlement in this northern paradise, that favors and help are conspicuously absent, that she is unwilling to open her markets to what is, in a way, her own child.
That is only temporary, said Duquet sullenly, not liking these truths.
You will see how temporary, and remember this conversation, if France comes to war with one of the powers and, not doing well, is forced to give up something. How long do you think New France will stay inviolate?
In the months since they had arrived, Captain Verdwijnen arranged to have the ship hauled onto a nearby beach where it could be cleaned, everything removed from the interior. 100 Chinese men removed the ordure-coated ballast stones from the bilges and laid them in the beating surf, scraped down the bilges, removed the stinking limber ropes and threaded new ones. They laid down a bed of clean sand before replacing the surf-scoured ballast, scraped the exterior bottom free from barnacles and seaweeds, for it was an uncoppered ship, recaulked and repainted the vessel inside and out. The Steyn Arendt was refloated, and for days long lines of men carrying chests and boxes packed the hold. The reprovisioned ship was fresh and clean, stuffed with the luxury goods of the China trade and 50 flowering plants. They set off for the Bay of Bengal with crates of lemons and mangoes to keep them safe from scurvy. In India, Captain Verdwijnen exchanged some of the ceramics and silks for more cabbages and fruit, spices, especially cloves and pepper, and picked up a chest of Patna opium for the medicinal trade in Amsterdam. Duquet's busy mind, once again dense with forest thoughts, took note.
Such a three-corner trading route could work for a lumber merchant, could it not?
Yes, but in my case the profits would be better if I bought the opium going forward, for there is a growing market in China for it. But we were pressed for time. Many foreign traders are taking advantage of the demand. Why should I not as well? But perhaps you were not thinking of opium.
But yes, I was.
He was 32 and on the way to his fortune. 14. Risk. On the home voyage, some of the sailors refused to drink the scurvy-preventing lemon juice and threw the mangoes overboard, as they had the oranges and bok choy when they thought they were unobserved. Those who were caught had the choice of sucking 2 lemons dry or enduring 10 lashes. Most chose the lashes, for they believed that salt meat, hardtack, and cheese so stale and granitic they had to be cut with an axe were manly foods suited to sailors. Lemons were not well regarded. Captain Verdwijnen smiled and said he hoped they would enjoy their scurvy. And soon enough, those men began to move stiffly, leaving bloodstains on their hardtack, bending double with gut-ripping pains. There was great laughter one day, and Toppent, seeking the cause, found one of the lemon-haters staring at his ration of hardtack. He had tried to gnaw it, and it came away from his mouth bloodied and with 3 teeth embedded in it. Now the voyage seemed interminable, but Captain Verdwijnen made one more stop. The ship made port at Ghana, picked up 30 slaves and crowded them into the cargo hold with the crates of porcelain, the rare plants, and the chest of Patna. There was not a cat's whisker of free space on the vessel. In the dark hold, the slaves got at the contents of the opium chest, a fortuitous find which greatly eased their passage. They found and ate the rare plants, blossom, leaf, stem, root, and soil. It was only when they sighted France that the loss was discovered. Captain Verdwijnen, when he had recovered from his shock, drinking his evening jenever, put a question to Duquet.
"So, my friend, what think you of the value of those slaves now?"
Duquet thought before he answered. The affair had its comic side, but he would keep his smiles to himself.
"To you, they must have a very high value, for when you add up the cost of the slaves themselves, then cipher in what you paid for the plants and the opium, they become precious, likely far above the market price for slaves."
"Quite so," said Verdwijnen. "But it is more complicated than that, for neither the plants nor the opium have fixed prices that are the same everywhere. What amount might I have received for the opium, which is an expensive and desirable medicine? And what if some of the plants soared in value as tulips did in my grandfather's time? Should those estimated future prices be factored into the value of the slaves? And what about the slave buyer? He would see only a slave, not the opium and rare orchids the creatures ingested. To him, the value is the slave market price."
He thought a moment, then went on. "The slaves, opium, and plants were mine. That's all."
"But do you not hold marine insurance for this trip? With the men in the coffee house in La Rochelle?"
"That, too, is complicated. Of course, Herr Grinz's ship was insured by the coffee house men against loss, piracy, and wreck, and also his cargo of silk and tea, but the rest? No. Pete, Jan, and I are self-insured through our Parten Reedereien, so the risks fall equally on all of us. Pete and Jan own their ships. I alone had to hire out to Herr Grinz. They will share my losses, and I will share their profits."
Duquet nodded. The motion of the ship was very slight as they were passing through slick water in which long windrows of seaweed made a pattern like a gigantic tweed cloak. He felt slight sympathy for Captain Outre Verdwijnen, who had made a negligible profit from the long, perilous journey, very little to show for all his bargaining and diplomatic skills. Unexpected dangers in business were part of the game. Captain Verdwijnen gave a hard laugh and said, "It's always a risk, such a voyage. We might easily have lost the ship and all its contents. We might have lost our lives. We might have been captured by pirates and sold as slaves ourselves. I look on the pleasant side. We have evaded cyclones and pirates. I still have Marit's little table, and I still have the slaves. I'll get something for them, so in the end it is only the opium and the rare plants that I have lost. In any case, we Dutch do not mind taking a risk. If business and enterprise is a fruit, we understand risk is its inner kernel."
He stretched his legs and half-smiled.
"Besides, I also placed some bets at the coffee house before we sailed that the ship would not wreck, that we would dodge pirates, and that I would return very much alive and twice as clever. There is my profit."
And so they returned to France, where the Steenarend would stay for 3 weeks, Duquet chafing to see the new finery which would present him as a person of value and importance. 15. Hair. They were late arriving in Paris, and rather than go to the tailor's shop in the deepening dusk, Toppent and Duquet spent the night at an inn. The tailor seemed surprised to see them. Duquet, trying on his finery behind an embroidered screen with the help of Jules, the tailor's assistant, listened while Toppent and the tailor conversed.
"We have heard so many ships were lost in storms, and to pirates, that I thought yours was surely among them."
Not this time, said Toppent. Though we were severely lashed by typhoons and came close to being driven onto the rocks off the east coast of Africa, a vicious shore. There is more to the sea than water. There is the land that constricts it.
The sea is the master of all men.
Not our captain. He is a skilled navigator and of a pleasant nature, unlike most ship captains. He is a good man. This was my fourth voyage with him, and I will never ship out with another captain.
And if he dies? Asked the tailor. Will you accompany him on that voyage as well?
Ha ha, said Toppent. We'll see. It depends on his port of call. Duquet, a vision in blue, stepped out from behind the screen and turned about to show the fit of his costume.
So, said Toppent, even a prince would envy you.
The tailor held both hands up and praised Duquet's legs.
You are certainly a man not in need of calf pads. You, sir, have a well-turned leg.
After this blandishment, the tailor tried to wheedle more money from him.
It's for storage, and I gave the costume very much care, dusting the shoulders, airing it outdoors, protecting it from my cat.
Duquet took out his smallest coin and spun it on the tailor's table. The wigmaker's shop was closed, but with loud pounding they raised the proprietor, whose pointed nose gleamed wet. He coughed incessantly.
The powder on the wigs, you know, it's quite irritating. I have lately changed to a powder made from curious lichens that grow on rocks, and it does not trouble me so severely. I have heard they use it to poison wolves, so rest assured that your fine wig will never be plagued by those ferocious animals.
He brought the wigs out. Toppent's was black and glossy and very smart. Duquet's was enormous and heavy, of auburn color with countless long ringlets that cascaded down his back and over his shoulders.
Do you wish it powdered? Asked the wig maker.
He produced a hacking sound.
No, no, said Duquet, staring at himself in the shop's watery mirror.
Between the blue shimmer of the garments, the flash of his ivory teeth, and the expensive wig, he was transformed into an apparent gentleman. What Toppent, not altogether kindly, called a chainier, an almost gentleman. They left the street of shops, heading for a certain eating place. Toppent had heard the cook came from Bourgogne, and was a genius of the kitchen. This inn was in a distant street, and the longer they walked, the hotter Duquet became, until he felt his brains roasting, his shoulders laden with coals. His neck ached with the weight of the wig. The sun glowed as a smelting furnace. They pushed through the crowded streets, down alleys that ran at angles. A man, carrying a large covered tray on his shoulder, came toward them. He brushed past Duquet, who suddenly felt the expensive wig ripped from his head. He spun around in time to see the man with the tray running, and on the tray, a ragged child clutching Duquet's new wig. The load was heavy, and the man lurched as he ran.
"Auvelure! Auvelure!"
shouted Duquet and Toppent. A passerby stuck out his leg, and the man fell, the child, tray, and wig hurtling into the mud. The child scampered away at extraordinary speed, but the passerby held down the man. A crowd gathered and pinioned the thief.
It will be the galleys for him, said Toppent. He will join the Huguenots.
Duquet, in an icy rage, retrieved the huge wig that had cost him so much. It looked twice as large as before, quite the armful, as big as a mattress, and with clots of mud dangling from its curls. As he shook it, he saw it had become entangled with another wig, apparently stolen earlier than his and hidden beneath the cloth.
It's a good one, said Toppent, examining the modish second wig critically. You can sell it.
But as he examined it more closely, he grimaced.
It's full of lice and nits.
He held it up.
But you could have it fumigated and cleaned. It is a valuable wig.
While they were examining the hairy mass, the passerby, still holding the thief and craning his neck to better see the wigs, relaxed his grip a little, and the miscreant wrenched loose and ran into the faceless multitude. A chase was hopeless. Duquet had had enough of wigs for the day, and carrying his own under his arm, he strode away, Toppent carrying the lousy wig, running after him, calling, "Slow, slow!" By the time they reached the inn, they could laugh at the adventure. Duquet said they should return to the wigmaker and see what he would give for the stranger's wig. It might pay for their dinner. They recklessly ordered dishes with the feeling that someone else would pay, some good French wine. At last, sated and half-drunk, they ate a sweet tart, and after that, neither could move.
"We need coffee," said Toppent.
The innkeeper told them of a coffee-house 2 streets away. They waddled in that direction, passed it twice before seeing it, and went in. When they were finally restored to mobility and mental clarity, they returned to the wigmaker's shop, Toppent carrying the stolen wig. The man recognized it as one he had made himself for a great gentleman. He said he would return it to his client, but Duquet insisted on a reward, naming a sum that covered the cost of their lavish dinner. Moaning, the wigmaker paid it, protesting that his client would hardly pay twice, even for a stolen and returned wig. In the street, Toppent said the wigmaker would likely cleanse the wig, hide it away, and when the client came to him telling of the theft, the wigmaker would promise him a new one as like the old as a pea in the pod resembles its neighbor and charge an even greater sum, for the verisimilitude, than the wig's first sale.
"In truth," he said, "I believe the thieves are in the employ of the wigmakers."
A week later, dressed in his finery and wearing the ivory teeth and stifling wig, Duquet attended a formal return dinner at Captain Verdwijnen's house in Amsterdam. The captain and his wife Margriet, Captains Piet Roos and Jan Gossen, their wives, and Piet's 2 nearly grown daughters, Josina and Cornelia, made up the company. In the entrance hall, Duquet noticed the table Captain Verdwijnen had purchased for Margriet in Guangzhou. As Margriet looked him over, Duquet saw that her right eye was more kindly than the left, which shot out a ray of antipathy. He felt that eye erase his fine clothes, discard the wig, dissolve the ivory teeth, and identify him as a scavenging opportunist. He dared not eat anything but soup and gravy, as he did not wish to remove his teeth in company. They were inadequate for anything beyond blancmange. To avoid Madame Verdwijnen's cruel eye, all through the dinner, Duquet shot his own glances at young Cornelia. There was a resemblance to Piet, and she was passable, though certainly not a beauty. Her eyes were of a blue so pale they seemed white. Her nose was broad. She wore a dark brown silk dress with a filmy rough collar and an embroidered linen cap. Duquet made up his mind that she would be his wife. At the flashing thought of any opposition or denial, the inner tiger stirred. During his time in Amsterdam at a popular coffee house, Duquet met a colonial Englishman from Boston, Benton Dredd Peacock, dressed in smart clothes of the best quality, but with a face that seemed made from stale bread crusts. Most colonial settlers were of low circumstance. It was obvious Dredd Peacock was a moneyed gentleman. As they talked, Duquet learned Dredd Peacock had intimate business dealings with the newly appointed New England Royal Mast contractor, Jonathan Bridger. The man knew very much about the forest business in the colonies and made it clear that his allegiances lay with the colonists rather than the crown. And Dredd Peacock recognized in Duquet a man who knew how to get money from turnips if nothing else was at hand. Money was power, and Duquet gave off the smell of both. He was one of those men others wished to know, even while they despised him. Duquet gathered from the conversation the knowledge that many colonials bitterly disliked English rule and the public taxes that went, unfairly, said Dread Peacock, to support England's reckless wars. Especially did they dislike the restrictive policies of the Royal Board of Trade, which set stringent rules for cutting the dense and dominating forests, rules pressing on amounts and procedures for supplying the Royal Navy with ships' stores, masts, bowsprits, and yards, not to mention pitch and tar. The residents were incensed over the acts of trade and navigation, which clamped like vices on colonial trade. And this Bridger fellow was apt to be troublesome about the sale of townships and the cutting of mast trees. But, said Dread Peacock,
that man is eager to make a name for himself, and I believe he will respond to careful smoothing.
And Dread Peacock knew the Elisha Cooks, both formidable powers in colonial affairs. Dread Peacock, his breath heavy with black fumes, whispered to Duquet, his eyes casting about for listening spies,
as Dr. Cook says, we ought to have the rights to trade with the whole world if we have the enterprise to produce the goods and timber, to grow hemp. But these acts bind us at every turn.
Duquet suggested they move to a more private table near the back, and he ordered a flagon of rum. As the evening wore on, he learned there were many sly ways the New Englanders evaded those 1,001 strictures, most generally in collusion with colonial officials, especially the sawmill owners. Dread Peacock leaned closer, thinking an alliance with this brute could be to his purse's advantage. It was all about money.
Chief among these exigencies is procuring ownership of great white pine tracts by purchasing old township grants. One must cultivate understandings with men who enjoy political influence and connections. I have done so. The enemy is the King's Surveyor, a dotard in London who makes a big fluster examining the licenses and permits of lumbermen. He is cowardly and dare not come to the colonies lest he suffer an accident. He sends his henchmen, the lowest of men.
I would know more about acquiring those townships, said Duquet.
Armed with a dozen new names and Dread Peacock's promise to meet him on his return, Duquet sailed for Boston, reflecting that the great and important advantage of the colonies over New France was the ice-free ports. The Saint Laurent was locked in ice for 6 or even 8 months of the year. He found a small house in the colonial city, and for the next year practiced speaking English and cultivating acquaintances with men who could grant him favors, all introduced by Dread Peacock. Duquet did not quite trust Dread Peacock, yet the man was a tolerable woodsman, a grand walker with legs cutting distance as springily as sheep shearing blades. In the early spring, Duquet fell ill with cholera, gradually regaining his health. He planned one more trip to China, and then he would buy up old main land claims and paper townships. But first, he had to go north. 16. A Wicked Messenger, Fallen into Evil. Guy Dufour, Seigneur de Pibrac. Back in New France, Duquet reverted to buckskin and moccasins and set out to find the Trépanier brothers. Everywhere he went, there were stump-choked clearings, charcoal kilns, and settlers' cabins, for men were cutting maple trees to make charcoal. The English needed it for their glass and gunpowder factories and paid high prices. He could not find Toussaint and Fernand, but that could be explained by the new war. New France, Indians, and the English colonies to the south boiled with spies. There were constant ambushes by roving bands of combatants. Duquet was impatient to get the brothers aligned for another season of fur trading. They would dodge the fighting. Then it was cooler, and there was rain in the woods, the smell of leaf mold and mushrooms. The refreshed river hissed. He looked up at a sky that seemed set with rondels of thick glass. He found the brothers tearing out a beaver dam near their old hut on the Rivière des Fours. Both brothers, muddy and glad to leave the beaver dam for a reunion, were in fair health, though Toussaint's beard showed white side streaks, and Fernand groaned when he straightened up.
They call this Queen Anne's War, but it seems the continuance of our old antipathies, Toussaint said. I blame the Indian factions. One day a tribe is your enemy. The next, you are fighting beside them, or they stand back from the battle and smile, like the Iroquois.
I hope you do not think I came back to fight Indians and English, said Duquet sourly.
Many do feel an allegiance to New France, said Toussaint.
I feel an allegiance to gathering furs.
Toussaint poured water into the black kettle, and when it boiled, Duquet showed them somewhat officiously how to make tea. They sipped it, making wry faces. Duquet said they would develop a taste for it, that it was considered a luxury in Europe. He said he wished he had brought coffee for them, but it was extremely dear, and doubtless they would not like it, as it was very bitter. The rum was more welcome. He apologized for the small amount of fur money he gave them, told a tale of pirate capture and the loss of most of his profits. He was anxious to start trading again, and would surely make up the poor showing of this venture. Smoothly, he asked for their history. The brothers exchanged a long look. Toussaint said dryly that they had experienced coffee in Ville-Marie, nor was Duquet the only one to see the world. They had traveled on the Mississippi the last several years with Pierre Lemoine, the son of a man in Ville-Marie who had started his New France life as an indentured servant and become rich.
Some people now see that there should be French forts all across the land.
As Toussaint spoke, Duquet sensed that he was seething with the desire to build forts and fight the English, guessed that they disbelieved his pirate story. But what could they do? Enjoy the rum, that's what.
We went to find the true mouth of the river. Sacre bleu, I swear, some river. A maze of swamps and black waterways like spiderwebs. Lemoine explored in a canoe with an Indian and some soldiers. We stayed in the Indian village near the old La Salle fort.
Fernand picked up his brother's story, spoke rapidly, saying that other Indians had stayed in that village, a dozen of them from a Western Ocean tribe who had come to hunt bison.
For they do not have those beasts in their country. The Western Ocean hunters had packs of furs for trade. They came by those furs trading with the Norse Indians, who live near the world of ice.
Toussaint opened a small pack and showed 8 rich sea otter furs and 4 Arctic fox.
Ah,
Duquet stroked the sensual otter pelts. He draped one across his knee and slid his fingers into the caressing warmth. His mouth watered.
They said the North Indians had so many otter pelts, they paved the streets of their villages with them. They said the North Indians traveled with the Russians and all got sick.
He stretched out his hand for his otter fur in Duquet's hand and returned it to his pack.
Did the North Indians with the Russians trade willingly with the Western Ocean Indians?
Fernand made a deep sound.
At first, yes. Then they changed. The Russians were already dead, and the North Indians were dying when the Western Ocean Indians came on them. The sick North Indians did not want to trade. The Western Ocean men persuaded them.
Some of the persuasion was severe? Even fatal?
Fernand was fumbling with the second pack, Toussaint clearing his throat and frowning at his brother. But Fernand, always a braggart, said,
It is true. Look at this.
He withdrew a rolled skin and opened it out. The brilliant gold and black fur dazzled.
A tiger, he said. The Russians had it.
He stroked the striped pelt.
It is why the sick North Indians did not want to trade.
Toussaint turned away.
Where is the head?
Asked Duquet.
The head is valuable.
The Russians did not have the head. They likely ate it. One must look after oneself in this life. Isn't that right?
Right, said Duquet, watching Toussaint pull the tiger skin away from his brother and roll it. They would not give up that skin readily. The old, easy partnership was gone. In fact, thought Duquet, his feeling for New France was gone. Late in the night, each rolled up in his bison robe, he heard Toussaint's voice, low and rough, oppressing his brother. Duquet grew restless during this time with the Trépanier brothers, noting their cramped vocabularies, their repetitive stories, but he drove himself and the brothers into a short but frantic season of gathering furs, letting the Indian middlemen know he especially wanted wildcats. He kept two of the best aside as a present for Cornelia. He had told Pete of his intent to marry her, and although the captain had pursed his lips and shook his head in denial, Duquet thought he would agree when he heard of Duquet's accumulating wealth. The girl had good teeth and looked healthy enough, with broad hips, but each of her features was off-kilter, those colorless eyes too small, the wide nose, and heavy cheeks. But it was the father and his business connections, his allegiance with Captain Verdwijnen, that Duquet truly wished to marry. Cornelia was to give him the sons he needed to build his business empire. He looked now beyond mere wealth. The season passed, and when the time came for Duquet to return to La Rochelle and China, Toussaint mumbled that he and Fernand would keep their share of the furs unless Duquet would pay a high price for them on the spot.
"We know several traders now," said Toussaint.
For months they had built their evening fire apart from Duquet, and in the daytime conversed only with each other.
"We cannot wait years for your return, perhaps empty-handed if your pirates strike again." "We need ready money," said Fernand, "as we wish to rejoin Pierre Lemoine. He is in France preparing an expedition to the Caribbean."
He stared at the ground as he spoke, unwilling to meet Duquet's eyes, but the tiger was calm. The brothers had no idea what furs brought in China, nor would they ever know. Duquet had learned something about negotiations, and after 2 days of palaver with Toussaint, who spoke for himself and Fernand, Duquet made a wondrous bargain, except for the tiger skin and the white fox furs, which they would not give up.
"I have no doubt there are many adventures in the Caribbean attractive to coureurs de bois," he said, letting the sarcasm show.
Toussaint countered with acerbity,
"I understand the Dutch West Indies are a most lucrative market for lumber, and certainly nearer than France or China."
Duquet guessed the brothers were waiting for him to renew his offer of a partnership in the timber trade so that they might have the pleasure of refusing him. He said nothing. It was the parting of ways. He rose near midnight, disappeared as silently as fog. It was many hours later that the brothers discovered the tiger skin, the fox, and otter furs were gone.
Fernand cursed and said there was no verse in Pibrac to ease the situation, but at least they had got a little hard money.
"Let us drink a toast to that man whose sugar mouth disguises his gall-choked heart."
They opened the Genever and drank to the riddance of Duquet.
"Perhaps you'd rather have coffee," mocked Toussaint. "Oh no, it is too bitter for one so backward as I," answered Fernand.
17. Unto a horse belongeth a whip.
Guy Dufour, Seigneur de Pibrac.
He could barely waste time sleeping, for his mind was in ferment, his body burned with the intense desire to get on with things. All was occurring as he had hoped. The first morning light was like an armful of dry wood tossed on a fire, and he was choking with energy and ambition as he pulled on his clothes. He despised men who slept until the sun was high, inept laggards who would never be anyone. In Ville-Marie, before he had found the Trépanier brothers, Duquet had hired Boucheron to find and cut white and red cedar, balsam fir, and fragrant sumac. Others to shape and finish the wood into small boards. These were packed in odorless birch chests to preserve their natural fragrances. Indian women had gathered ginseng roots, bundles of sweetgrass, and other plants and roots for him. He chartered a ship, the Hendrick, to take him, his fragrant woods, his magic roots and furs, to La Rochelle, where he would meet Captain Verdwijnen. The ship's captain was Gabriel Déon, the son of Captain Déon, with whom he had first traveled to France years before. The son told Duquet his father had been lost, ship and all hands aboard, in the treacherous Strait of Magellan, whose narrow passageway he had chosen as a safe alternative to Cape Horn.
"One never knows," said Duquet piously.
But he knew. Déon's ship stopped at every settlement along the river. At dusk, it moored for the night at Wobeek, and Duquet went ashore to see what changes had come in the years since he had left. He could scarcely believe it. Where was the forest? The landscape had been corrupted. The village had swollen by 50 houses, a grain mill, a water-powered sawmill, a large sheep commons. The forest had been pushed out of sight, and in the place of woodlands were rough fields with crops growing between stumps. The muddy trail west that he remembered was now a fair road. For a moment he was frightened. If miles of forest could be removed so quickly by a few men with axes, was the forest then as vulnerable as beaver? No, the forest returned with vigor, resprouted from cut stumps, cast seeds, sent out mother roots from which new trees grew. These forests could not disappear. In New France, they were vast and eternal. One thing had not changed. Monsieur Bouchard still handled the passage money for river travel, still welcomed newcomers. The old man, looking strong though white-haired, did not recognize him. Duquet asked him to open the ledger where he had made his mark half his lifetime earlier. He pointed.
"There, that is my ignorant mark."
A few lines above, he saw the pathetically elaborate R of René Selle, and asked if he was still alive.
"Certainement. He has Monsieur Trépanier's old house, where he lives very comfortably with his wife and children. You knew, did you not, that Claude Trépanier met his untimely end seeking you, whom he determined to punish as a runaway?"
"I did not know. He was a vindictive, unforgiving master, and I was justified in leaving because of that maltraitement. He treated me badly."
"There are some who believe you had him dispatched by the Iroquois."
"What a canard! If the Iroquois killed him, it is because they had their own reasons."
And although he did not care, he diverted the conversation.
"So, René Selle has become a landowning farmer."
"He is a woodcutter and keeps a few cows and sheep out in the forest. But there are several farms near his place these days. He cuts firewood and makes potash. There are perhaps 6 good farms between here and Selle's place. As you can see, Wobeek has made tremendous progress in clearing and destroying the wilderness. The only person who laments this labor is that sauvage Marie, René's wife. She has become a woman of some importance for her abilities to heal the sick. She mourns the loss of woodland grottos where certain plants once grew, but are no more because of the industry of the settlers. She speaks out more and more against the white settlers. We cannot subdue that streak of vengeance that is part of their character. Her Indian sons have gone to the village of Saint Francis, which is crowded with rebellious Indians of every tribe."
"Marie!" cried Duquet. "Married to Marie! But she is much older. Surely a country marriage."
"No. Trépanier forced it years ago so that he would not lose his rich French wife. In the end, he lost her and everything else, even his life."
"His brothers do not know this," said Duquet.
"Ah, but they do. I told them myself at the time of the events. By rights, they should have inherited at least Claude's big stone house, but they did not wish it. They are wandering men with good hearts, and said the house should go to one who was content to be a woodcutter."
I expect they are both dead by now, killed by Indians or drowning.
No doubt, said Duquet. If they are not in the Caribbean, whipping slaves.
With that, he took his leave and returned to the ship. He felt stifled. He was ready to get away. He had longed to be back in the northern forest, but now that he was here, he wished for the glittering worlds of La Rochelle, Paris, Amsterdam, even Canton, as the English called Guangzhou. New France had nothing for him now, except timber.
A hard one, murmured Monsieur Bouchard to himself. Hardened. Very much hardened.
18. Reunion. As the ship entered the Bay of Biscay, the pale limestone cliffs of La Rochelle gleamed in the first strike of sunlight. Duquet could smell salted cod, the smoke of twisted salt grass from the fires of the poor. Despite the early hour, a crowd of fishermen and mariners were on the wharf looking for share employment. Once they had worked the Newfoundland coast, but this was increasingly dangerous and difficult as the English and the New England colonists and even the Spanish and Dutch were pushing in. The La Rochelle boats now fished the offshore Grand Banks, where the poissons were larger, stouter, and sweeter than those along the coast, and closer to home. In La Rochelle, while he waited for Captain Verdwijnen and his ship, Duquet carried two boxes of his specialty woods one day to the shop of Claude Citron, the merchant who, on his first journey years earlier, had expressed warm interest in unusual cabinet woods. Citron was older now, but no less fervent on the subject of woods.
Ah, he said, as if Duquet had been in only the day before instead of long years. Let us see what you have brought from New France. Delights, I am sure.
Duquet set his sample boxes of scented cedar and balsam on the table, a few pieces of figured maple. He explained that he was taking most of his stock to China. Citron handled the satiny wood, sniffed and tilted the pieces to catch the light.
You know, I am connected with esteemed cabinet makers always anxious to buy fine woods. You are taking your fragrant woods to China? They would find a market here as well, you know, but I suppose the profits will be greater in China, though the cost of shipping and the possibility of loss to pirates and storms greater. You might consider it.
He would make some money selling the cabinet woods to Citron, but it was the fur and growing opium profits of the China trade that made the hazardous journey worthwhile. For this last time, he thought. With the break from the Trépanier brothers, he was at the end of his fur trading days. He was a wealthy man, and although he was strong and hale, he felt the pressure of time. He wanted much more now. From now on, he would concentrate on his forest empire. He settled on a price for two boxes of his scented woods, said farewell, and turned toward the wharves. He passed a patisserie emanating essences of sugared fruit and chocolate, then a small open-air market packed with great luscious lettuces and early onions. It was remarkable how much more interesting the smells of La Rochelle were than those of Boston. He was staying at the Botte de Mer, the oddly named Sea Boot, a good enough inn with private beds and even private rooms, but the attraction was the extraordinary and ever-changing menu. Night after night, an accomplished and inventive cook sent out salpicons, cassoulets, and ragouts of sweetbreads or chopped pheasant or chicken, various fish, mushrooms, all savory, all seasoned with the local salt. The cassoulets were especially succulent. Alas, there were only six small tables and two sittings each evening. If you were unfortunate enough to be the seventh diner at the second sitting, you would be rejected. Duquet had no intention of being turned away and looked forward keenly to that evening's meal. But first, he would store his remaining wood samples. As he started up the staircase that led to the upper rooms, someone spoke at his shoulder in a quiet but familiar voice.
Duquet, Is it you?
Tiens! Forgeron! I thought you to be in Nouvelle-France!
Lean and dark Forgeron stood at his shoulder.
Of course. I was there for many years. But 2 years since, I have been surveying in the Maine woods. You cannot believe the white pine in Maine.
He smiled. You are looking very well. Clearly you have progressed.
Forgeron, you too look well. Healthy and strong. This meeting is fortuitous. I have wished often to speak with you about the Maine forests.
I have wished often to tell you of the opportunities for the timber business in Maine. Have you visited that region?
Only a little. Indeed, I am planning to explore further as soon as this, my last journey to China, ends. Let us dine together and tell all that has come our way since last we met. What affairs have brought you to La Rochelle?
I was in London to speak with an Englishman who has just won a mast contract for some crown lands in Maine. He wants me to survey the area and arrange for woodsmen to cut masts. But I foresee difficulties with this fellow. He had other masts cut several years ago and stored them at his property in the West Indies. He was unable to sell them for reasons I do not understand, and the masts perished from dry rot. He could not pay the cutting contract, and the affair is now in the courts. So I am not eager to accept his offer.
In came their cassoulet of veal and chicken with pink beans and a loaf of still-warm bread as large as a bull's head. They drank good Burgundy, and when it was gone, Forgeron raised his hand for more.
"I have a suggestion," said Duquet. "Why do we not renew our friendship and practice joint business? I shall be 2 years on this last trip, but perhaps you could survey Maine timberlands for me and purchase townships for Duquet et fils while I am away."
"What? You have sons? You have married?"
"No, no, but I hope soon this will come to pass."
And he told Forgeron of Cornelia, of his plans for a timber empire, and his hope that Forgeron would share in this.
"I do not know if Amsterdam should be the seat of this business, or New France, or even the English colonies. Should I bring Cornelia to the New World?"
"I would suggest that Boston, with its great and open harbor, its connections to London, and to other colonies by way of the Post Road, the newspapers which inform, the mail service between Boston and New York and the Connecticut towns, and its nearness to the main pineries, is the most advantageous location."
"I had nearly come to that conclusion myself, and your opinion settles the matter. Forgeron, if you work with me, I will make you a rich man."
"Or will I be the one who makes you the wealthy fellow?"
They laughed and clasped hands. 19. Exitus in dubio est. In Amsterdam, Captains Piet Ros and Verdwijnen at a table in their favorite coffee house discussed the possibility of the match.
"I do not like the man," said Piet.
"Beneath the pleasant manner, he is cold and calculating. He is more addicted to his own interests than anything else.
There is something in the way that ugly head sits on his shoulders that signals defeat to anyone with whom he converses. He smiles often, yes, but while his lips curve, his eyes remain like dried peas. I detect no real fondness for my daughter. His conversation is always about his wishes, his plans, his travels, and his money. Of the rest of life, aside from his personal advantage, he knows little."
"Yes, I agree that may be true. His is a rough and masculine view, though I have seen him pleased with the Chinese garden. But he is already wealthy, and in a way to command enormous sums."
"Yes, I like money as well, but not as Duquet does. With him, it is a sinful greed. Nothing else matters."
Captain Verdwijnen took down his clay pipe from its ceiling hook. He sat again, spilled tobacco leaves on the table, and began to cut them fine.
"He has a monstrous good head for business, and, as you say, a will to dominate. And a rather terrifying lust for work. If Cornelia weds him, it would be a familial tie to a great deal of money and credit.